je dis seulement un petit mot. Merci à tous d'être ici. J'ai l'honneur trop grand pour moi de présenter donc, le professeur Detlefsen en l'absence du professeur Tiercelin qui malheureusement n'a pas pu être présente aujourd'hui. Elle vous prie de l'en excuser, elle était vraiment désolée. Et je ne présente pas donc, le professeur Detlefsen que vous connaissez, qui est un grand philosophe des mathématiques, professeur invité au Collège de France et dans toutes les affilié à toutes les prestigieuses institutions que vous voyez. Et donc je vous cède la parole.
Thanks a lot, Jean-Marie, for that. So I'll begin with a little bit of review of what we covered last week that's of relevance to what I plan to say today. The first thing I did was to make a distinction between two types of axiomatizations or axiomatic plans, as I sometimes call them. The one was a synthetic plan, and its characteristics were that the primitively evident propositions over a language, say, are deductively powerful, so they're actually good points at which to begin investigations. You can go a long way with those. And then there's another type of axiomatization described in some detail by Whitehead and Russell in Principia that I call analytic axiomatization. And that's a scheme where the primitively evident propositions are logically weak. Okay, and so in order to get anywhere, you have to first find some axioms, some powerful principles. Hope you've got enough hypothetico-deductive evidence to make them evident, and then you can actually get going with some justification. Okay, I described synthetic and analytic axiomatization as having a common organizational goal. I called it a compressive goal. And that, simply stated, is to maximize the harvest of the primitively justified propositions. And by that I meant to maximize a certain ratio in blue. All right, and the idea is that the higher this ratio, the greater the justificative compression, and the more work, the more valuable an axiomatization is. Now, this was all said as an attempt to make some more than casual sense of a perennial demand among people writing on the axiomatic method have made on axioms, and that is that they be small in number. Why small in number? Okay. One wouldn't pay so much attention to this if it weren't such a constant refrain of people writing on foundations. Okay, so my attempt to make some sense of that was to introduce this notion of justificative compression, all right, which gives us some kind of way. Now, I didn't do it precisely, all right, but perhaps I said enough to be suggestive on the point. Okay, so anyway, that was my attempt to make sense of this constraint. When we minimize the number of axioms, that's a movement towards maximizing the ECR ratio, epistemic compression ratio. So along with this, there was a simple picture of analytic axiomatization that emerged, all right, and it's more or less the picture that Whitehead and Russell invoked in the Principia to justify their project. And that the reasoning behind it, the salient points of the reasoning behind it are on the bottom half of the page. Increasing the number of primitively evident propositions that regressively support, that is inductively support, the axioms can increase the strength of the justification for axioms. When you do that, you can increase the value of the ECR. Okay, and so sometimes, rather than minimizing the number of primitively evident propositions, you get more value, more gain by maximizing them. Okay, so this was by way of raising a question about this minimization idea. Okay, and I went through more details than this last time on that. I won't repeat those here today. You're free to ask me if you want to in the discussion, of course. So then I introduced a notion that I called descriptive completeness, because this seemed to be something that interested Whitehead and Russell too. And as it turns out, it's something that interested a great number of the people who did foundational writing in mathematics in the later part of the 19th century and the early part of the 20th century. Here I've glossed actually, descriptive completeness as that property of a system of proofs when it proves all the data or all of these evident propositions or propositions identified as evident or something in that neighborhood. I'll actually survey a small number of variants on descriptive completeness a little later. Well, anyway, the idea was that descriptive completeness, if you have a descriptively complete theory, it will maximize the regressive support for a set of foundational axioms of the sort that Whitehead and Russell were pursuing. And when it does that, it will increase the value of the total epistemic product, okay, the total justificative strength, if you will, of the principles. And when you do that, you increase that crucial epistemic compression ratio, because you get more justificative value out of your primitively evident propositions. Such, anyway, seemed to be the Whitehead-Russell reasoning for wanting descriptive completeness in their system. I'll take a look at a couple of passages where they said things like this in just a short time. Okay, so now descriptive completeness then became for Whitehead and Russell a kind of ideal of axiomatization. And it was accepted as an ideal also by people who were involved in what you might think of as competing projects with Whitehead and Russell. That is, people who were seeking alternative systems of principles that could serve as something that in those times was known as a foundation for mathematics. All right, and for instance, the people doing a different kind of set theory from that pursued by Frege. Frege was an example of this too, but in his case, he ran into problems with his proposals. All right, so I'm pausing here than to just call attention to a distinction I make between foundational theories, which are these very powerful theories that somehow try to organize the whole of mathematics, versus more local types of axiomatizations that don't aim to organize the whole of our mathematical knowledge, but aim just to organize some part of it. Okay. So now let's look at some sample statements of descriptive completeness from the period I'm talking about. The first comes from Whitehead and Russell, okay, who described in the preface to the first volume of the Principia, they described their project this way. In constructing a deductive system such as that contained in the present work, there are two opposite tasks which have to be concurrently performed. On the one hand, we have to analyze existing mathematics with a view to discovering what premises are employed and whether they are capable of reduction to more fundamental premises. On the other hand, when we have decided upon our premises, we have to work the other way. We have to build up again as much as may seem necessary of the data previously analyzed. All right. The chief reason, and this is a very important statement, this is his advocation of descriptive completeness. The chief reason in favor of any theory on the principles of mathematics must always lie in the fact that the theory in question enables us to deduce ordinary mathematics. That's the chief qualification any foundational theory can have, is this descriptive completeness or descriptive adequacy, according to Whitehead and Russell. This, by the way, is a statement that they made not only in Principia, but many times throughout the joint writing of the two. Whitehead was less repetitious as a writer, generally, than Russell was. But you certainly find this statement made many times in Russell's writings and from many different quarters, not just his work on the foundations of mathematics. Okay, so I want then to distinguish something I call an analytic task in this description of the Principia project, which is the task of discovering an organizational scheme, a set of founding axioms upon which to base mathematics. And then there's this synthetic task, the colors match, okay? There's a synthetic task, which Russell describes as having found the principles building back out and retrieving all of the data that you, for which you're trying to construct an organizing theory. And then in the light blue, we have this statement of descriptive completeness being a premier credential for foundational theory. Okay, well, foundational theories are one thing, however, and ordinary theories are something else. Could it be the case that there's something special to foundational theories that would make descriptive completeness a compelling ideal that isn't as strong for weaker theories? Okay. Well, I'm not going to directly address that question right now. I will say something about it in the longer talk today. But I just want to show you what others said about that. Okay, and so Veblen, who's not known primarily as a figure in the foundations of mathematics, but in truth is, I think, one of the most interesting foundational writers there is, not least because he was so daring in his ideas. He just came, I mean, if he thought something, he actually tried to describe it. Anyway, he was very skillful and suggestive that way. I recommend him, in case you haven't read lots of Veblen's stuff. He said, anyway, talking about the foundations of geometry, so not an entire foundational system for mathematics, but a foundational system for part of mathematics, geometry. The problem of the foundations of geometry is to find a system of axioms that's necessary and sufficient for geometry, necessary in that no axiom can be dispensed with, and sufficient for the whole deduction, for the deduction of the whole system of geometrical knowledge. So there you see this idea of descriptive completeness applied to a local theory. A foundation for geometry has a responsibility to something that might as well be called data. Those data are what Veblen describes here as the whole system of geometrical knowledge. Okay. Huntington. A miscellaneous collection of facts does not constitute a science. In order to reduce it to a science, the first step is to do what Euclid did in geometry, namely to select a small number of the given facts as axioms, and then to show that all other facts can be deduced from these axioms by the methods of formal logic. There's no regressive structure in this, notice. You start with some evident facts that circumscribes your choices for axioms. So you don't try to elevate evidence for some weak set of propositions to justifications for some stronger propositions, which will then become your axioms. Okay, so Huntington seemed to have a pretty synthetic, as opposed to analytic, conception of the foundational task. I mention this because you may not have come across it. It's not in a piece of writing that's widely available. It's more widely available now that there's been a collection of some of Hilbert's lecture notes, okay? Anyway, it represents what I think is the clearest statement of descriptive completeness as an ideal of axiomatization, local axiomatization, actually all kinds of axiomatization according to this statement in Hilbert, all right. So most often Hilbert didn't talk about descriptive adequacy or descriptive completeness. He talked about other kinds of completeness. Right? Here he does talk about descriptive completeness. All right. Now, this is quite early, notice. And then there is a Dutch writer who, again, is one of the more interesting 20th century foundational writers that I know of. And he tried to give a general formulation of descriptive adequacy. So he kind of tried to provide a framework for talking about descriptive completeness, descriptive adequacy, other kinds of adequacy as well. In fact, he tried to generalize the concept of adequacy by saying, well, there are two theories. One of them is what you might call a data theory, and the other one is the capturing theory. So we got a target theory and a targeting theory, all right? And then he defines what a kind of generalized conception of descriptive adequacy would amount to here, okay? Actually, much of the terminology that I use is from Huntington. I discovered this only after the fact, and after I started using the terminology, I was encouraged by it, so I thought it wasn't completely artificial. So for instance, he speaks of descriptive adequacy and descriptive completeness. He talks about analytic and synthetic axiomatization, and he raises some other distinctions that I'll mention later on. Okay, but the idea is that when you're axiomatizing, you're doing so against the background of some pre-axiomatic goings-on, all right? And we could idealize the pre-axiomatic goings-on as a theory of some, as comprising a theory of some sort. And the axiomatizer's responsibility is to organize, is to organize the data set by axiomatizing it. This comes from his terrific little book called Axiomatic Projective Geometry, by the way, which I just, that's actually mostly where I learned my projective geometry from, so I've got a warm place in my heart for it. Okay, so now let's gather the salient points of this little survey that I've done. Here are three different statements of descriptive completeness. One is from the Principia project, where descriptive completeness amounts to capturing currently existing mathematics in its entirety. The second is what I call the Hilbert-Huntington localized variant, which says that a condition on the adequacy of axiomatizing a local theory is to capture the known facts pertaining to that subject. Okay, and then this generalized formulation of descriptive completeness that we find in Heiting, okay, where we have a target theory and a targeting theory. Okay. There are different rationales for descriptive completeness that go along with these different conceptions of it, all right? So you'll notice, for instance, that you could satisfy the Russellian version of descriptive completeness by not accounting for all and only true propositions. All right, what you're really trying to do is to account for what people count as belonging to a theory. All right, so this is a kind of already highly epistemological view of descriptive completeness. All right, Hilbert and Huntington have a slightly different idea, and that is that you're not just supposed to capture what people count as belonging to geometry or algebra or the whole of mathematics. You're supposed to actually count for all of the propositions that are known. Okay, and this makes a lot of sense in terms of the Whitehead-Russell strategy, because you only get this hypothetical justification of the big principles if you start from evident premises. Okay, just having things that people believe isn't going to do you any good. All right, there has to be evidence, and that's all that does any good. Okay, so anyway, I'm saying that on the, well, I'll just give a summary here. I won't read this out. You can read it. There's nothing very very complicated there. What I want to do at this point, though, is to make the same observation three times. Okay, and that is that completeness with respect to identified practice or identified fact or some target set doesn't imply Gödelian completeness. Okay, and this means that at least in principle, you ought to be able to satisfy what at least Whitehead and Russell and these other writers counted as the premier qualification for an axiomatization of a subject or discipline without its being Gödelian complete. Okay, so descriptive completeness doesn't imply Gödelian completeness. All right, and so I hope that that raises a question in your mind about how damaging then it would be to find that a theory you had proposed as an axiomatization for this or that subject, or even a grand axiomatization for the whole of mathematics, that it was Gödelian incomplete. Would that mean it was consigned to some sort of inferior status? And I think the answer is no. Not if, in fact, the premier qualification is descriptive completeness. But I'll say more about this. This is just a sort of foreshadowing of what I'm going to say. So now let's take a, since we haven't done a very, very careful job of stating what Gödelian completeness is. Now's the time, perhaps, to do that for those of you. I'm sure almost all of you are familiar with it anyway. I decided that, that it was maybe a good idea to formulate it alongside Heiting's general formulation of descriptive completeness. And then you can see more clearly the conditions under which they'd be equivalent. Okay. I don't find it convenient in a talk to read things like this. Okay, so, and I don't think you probably find it convenient as a listener to have it read to you, so I'll just put these up occasionally so that you'll see what I mean and compare it with what you think I should mean. All right. By the way, oh yeah, what I'm calling Gödelian completeness has got other, more common names. Okay, it's often called syntactical completeness, negation completeness. Those are two common names for it. Okay, I'm calling it Gödelian completeness because Gödel figures very significantly in these talks. Okay, so, question. When is the target set? Heiting's D. When is that set Gödelian complete? Is it in the case of the Principia project? I think the answer there is no, and there's the statement right below. The chief reason in favor of any theory on the principles of mathematics, he doesn't say, must always lie in the fact that it's Gödelian complete. He says instead, must always lie in the fact that the theory in question enables us to deduce ordinary mathematics. So if ordinary mathematics is Gödelian complete, then, yeah, the foundation will have to be Gödelian complete too. But if it's not, then apparently, according to the way Whitehead and Russell understood their project, the answer would be no. Well, I take liberty and elevate this to something I call the Whitehead-Russell thesis. Okay, I mean, it would take obviously a lot more careful textual arguing to justify this, but I'm just going to lay my cards on the table here and tell you what I think I could do if we had time enough to do it. And that is, you'd get this thesis called the Whitehead-Russell thesis, which says that the prime qualification as regards extent for any foundational axiomatization is that it be descriptively complete with respect to the ordinary mathematics it is supposed to found. Okay, now there's this funny word extent, as regards extent. So I actually weakened Russell's claim because he didn't make that qualification. Okay, he just said the premier qualification is descriptive completeness. But I don't think, of course, that in a sober moment he would have elevated it above consistency or something like that. So I want to then limit this claim to qualifications that I call qualifications regarding extent. So if there are features on what's inside your theory that should serve as constraints on its adequacy, what are they? I'm saying that the Whitehead-Russell answer to that question is, yeah, it's this descriptive completeness that does that. That tells you, that's the premier constraint on the extent of the theory, or the extension of the theory, if you like. And then I give a generalization of this thesis, which is not something that I think you'll find stated in any explicit form in Whitehead and Russell. At least I haven't found it. Philippe, maybe you know someplace where they did. If you do, it'd be cool if you'd give me a reference here. I don't know of a place where they say this, but it was actually a fairly common sort of statement made. And in fact, some of the statements I surveyed from Veblen and Huntington amount to this, generalized. So the generalization, I call it generalized because it's not just specific to foundational theories. That's what the Whitehead-Russell thesis is. It's a thesis about foundational theories and their adequacy. A generalized thesis is a thesis about all kinds of theories, all right? Axiomatic theories. Okay, now, why am I interested in this? Well, I'll tell you, try to tell you a little bit, very briefly, why I got interested, and it was from reading this remark in Gödel and trying to make some real sense out of it. Okay. So Gödel said, Whitehead and Russell constructed logic and mathematics by initially taking certain evident propositions as axioms and deriving the theorems of logic and mathematics from these. When such a procedure is followed, the question at once arises whether the initially postulated system of axioms and principles is complete, that is, whether it actually suffices to deduce every logico-mathematical sats, okay, or whether perhaps it's conceivable that there are true propositions that cannot be derived in the system under consideration. There's so much to say about this passage that I can't begin to say it all today, or we would be here a very long time indeed. Okay, but I'll try it. The colored parts are the parts that I want to talk about today. Let's look at that first statement in the brighter shade of blue. Whitehead and Russell constructed logic and mathematics by initially taking certain evident propositions as axioms and deriving the theorems of logic and mathematics from those. Well, not according to Russell, that's not what Whitehead and Russell did. Not according to Whitehead either, okay? They didn't initially take evident propositions that were going to be axioms for them. This overlooks the whole regressive or inductive structure, justificative structure in Principia. All right, their axioms, they didn't find evident axioms to serve as the axioms of their system. Russell, in fact, went to considerable lengths to say that the very opposite was the case. All right, and that one wasn't going to be able to defend their principles as real principles without a very extensive inductive, or what he called a regressive justification for those. Okay, so, well, all right, so that may be a maldescription of what Whitehead and Russell's, the justificative structure of Whitehead and Russell's project, but is it anything more serious than that? Well, I won't answer that question right now. Okay, I will suggest an answer to it later on, but I'd like to pass to the next point in this passage. He says, when such a procedure is followed, the question at once arises whether the initially postulated system of axioms, there's that initially business again, postulated now? Oh, so they're not even evident? They were evident a moment ago, now they're postulated, all right? Anyway, the initially postulated system of axioms and principles of inference is complete. That question immediately arises. Well, what is that question? Well, take your pick. He gives you more than one choice. One way to look at this completeness question is whether the system in question suffices to deduce every logico-mathematical sats. And there's that terrible term, sats. Okay, which can mean just about anything you want it to mean, and probably several things you don't want it to. All right, it can mean truth, it can mean theorem, it can mean proposition. Those are three prime things. But of course, the claim is very different depending upon which of those you take as your reading. If I say truth, then my system has to prove every truth formulable in a language, all right? If I say proposition, now then I've got a lot of explaining to do, okay? I could do that, I mean, because the term proposition also has a fairly well-established mathematical meaning that isn't just a linguistic proposition, it's something else, not just something with content. And the third reading would be that it's a theorem. Okay, if you take the theorem reading, then this is just descriptive completeness again. All right? So now let's look at that transition from the red to the light blue. Okay, here we've got proves every zots, or whether it's conceivable that there be a truth that's not provable. Okay? Well, if those are truly alternatives, then you've disambiguated the red part. Okay? Because sots there means truth. All right. Okay? If you really do take the or whether here seriously and strictly. So this then would be the first place that you find in Gödel's publications where something like Gödelian completeness is broached. And he describes that as a question that arises at once whenever you have a project like the Whitehead-Russell project. I found this striking because, you will have guessed, I would have thought the question that arises at once is a question of descriptive completeness, since that's the premier qualification regarding extent for a foundational theory. That's the question that you should be first concerned with, all right? But that's not what you get out of this passage, okay? This was a kind of important, I don't want to make a mountain out of a molehill, I may have already done that, all right? And I'm not just trying to find as many ways as I can of pointing some kind of finger at blame at a great logician and also philosopher, I think. But this is telling to me because it, in a sense, is a motivating idea for Gödel's taking completeness in the way he did. All right. It is a question that arises at once for real projects, like the one of Whitehead and Russell. Okay. So anyway, I'll finish this by just saying I think there are differences between Gödel's description of the Principia project and Whitehead and Russell's description of the Principia project, and I don't think they're superficial. They're pretty hard-hitting and pretty important. And I think there's a slide in the red from the red to the blue. And it's a slide that may have been easy enough. I can understand this slide better if it was made by someone other than Gödel. Okay? Because it wouldn't have been too much to think that theories, at least some theories back there, big strong ones like the Principia system, could prove every truth. Okay? If you believe that, then that wouldn't be an objectionable slide. But Gödel didn't believe that, not even in 1930. Okay. So, that was Gödel on Principia. Now let's take a look again at Whitehead and Russell. This is just the passage from Gödel again. I'm going to talk about Whitehead and Russell's view, though. To summarize what I said, I think in contrast to the bright blue statement, the axioms of Principia Mathematica were not initially taken to be evident by Whitehead and Russell, nor were they, certainly, were they not postulated, nor given their express statement of the importance, the premier status of descriptive completeness as a constraint on PM, is it right to suggest that their procedure gave rise at once to a question of good delegate completeness of PM. Okay. And I think what we learn from this, this is at least what I take from this, mainly is that Gödel seems to have had a largely synthetic understanding of the Principia project, and Whitehead and Russell had a largely analytic understanding of it. Okay. Well, I mean, it would take much longer for us to really try to decide how important that difference of understanding, if in fact it is a difference, is. I think it actually is fairly important. I've tried to indicate why. So now I think I'll just try to encapsulate this first part of my talk today by summarizing the main claims that come out of it. The first is that Gödelian incompleteness is no obstacle to descriptive completeness. The second is that Gödelian completeness is no obstacle to descriptive compression. Okay. And I put that in, of course, because Gödelian incompleteness is an obstacle to some kinds of compression. Okay, for instance, it poses a limitation on the axiomatic compressibility of all kinds of sets of propositions, like, say, the set of truths of the language of arithmetic, first order language of arithmetic. Last but not least, Gödelian completeness is no obstacle to descriptive axiomatization. That, I think, is the most important of the three. That's what the other two are leading up to. Okay. That second one, I mean, I haven't talked much about compression today. I talked all the time about it last time. All right. One thing you might think is that even if the descriptive adequacy of a theory, like, say, Principia Mathematica, even if the descriptive adequacy of it weren't jeopardized by Gödelian completeness, if its organizational virtue was what it brings to the organization of the knowledge that it organizes, if that were somehow in jeopardy, that would also be very serious. So I think that this is a substantial claim. It may not be true. I didn't argue much for it today. That's because I kind of assumed you'd forget enough from last lecture not to press me too hard on the details of the thinking behind this. But anyway, it is a claim that I would make and think it's important to make in this connection. Okay. So now I want to talk about another type of axiomatization. The strategy of my talk today is really this. I want to look back at the history of mathematics and answer the question, what are the historically most important forms or types of axiomatization? And my answer to that are descriptive axiomatization, that is to say, axiomatization conceived as Whitehead and Russell conceived it and described it. Okay? And the other one is what I call creative axiomatization. And that's what we're going to talk about now. And I'm going to say, I've already said, that Gödelian incompleteness does not pose an obstacle to the realization of the goals of descriptive axiomatization. And now I'm going to argue for the parallel claim in the case of creative axiomatization. And if I'm right about this, then the two most important axiomatizing strategies in the history of mathematics are neither one of them seriously affected by Gödelian incompleteness. Okay. But let me wait to make that point. So, creative axiomatization. First thing is, it doesn't fit very well Heiting's general formulation of descriptive completeness, because it's really not aimed at capturing some pre-axiomatic body of reasoning. It's not aimed at doing that at all. Rather, it regards axiomatization as a method for introducing concepts or expressions by providing a complete set of conditions for their usage. I'll say more about what that completeness there means. It doesn't mean Gödelian complete. If it did, my overall claim for creative axiomatization would be very different from what it will be. So applying this conception of axiomatization to the theory of the real numbers, Hilbert said this: the totality of real numbers is not the totality of all possible series and decimal fractions, or of all possible laws according to which the elements of a fundamental sequence may proceed. It is rather a system of things whose mutual relations are regulated by the axioms set up, and for which all propositions and only those are true which can be derived from the axioms by a finite number of logical processes. Okay. Kind of confusing, I think. So what's Hilbert trying to tell us? Well, one thing is that a theory of the continuum is not obliged to capture what are commonly taken to be familiar facts concerning the continuum. Is that one of the things he's trying to tell us? Sounded like it. Okay. Actually, he'll change that answer as he expands it, and he'll really change it explicitly in the Grundlagen der Mathematik, the first volume in 1934. We'll see a passage from that later. More specifically, I think, though, Hilbert is saying that we're free to introduce and study concepts of our own making. All right? We don't have to take pre-axiomatic mathematics as it is and not do anything to it. We're free to change it in a variety of ways. Okay. So much so, in fact, that descriptive adequacy becomes, descriptive completeness becomes a much less compelling constraint on axiomatization than it did under descriptive axiomatization. Here's how Dedekind described creative axiomatization. If in the consideration of a simply infinite system N, set in order by a transformation phi, we entirely neglect the special character of the elements, retaining only their distinguishability and taking into account only the relations to one another in which they're placed by the order-setting transformation phi, then are these elements called natural numbers or ordinal numbers or simply numbers? With reference to this freeing the elements from every other content, that's his term, abstraction, we are justified in calling the numbers a free creation of the human mind. Okay, well, there may be something that counts as data for the doing of arithmetic, but, says Dedekind, we're going to change that. We're not just going to take what's given to us and not do anything to it. We're free to do all kinds of things to it because we're actually tool makers. All right, and tool makers get to change the natural resources that they find in the world. All right. Well, there are a couple of things that I want to emphasize from this remark. And that is that abstraction, notice, is a choice. It's actually an act of will. Okay, so there's an agent involved here. There's a question of agency, potentially. I mean, perhaps it's not going to be of central importance. Maybe it will be. All right, but certainly there's a choice, an act, an exercise of will, so a volitional element. And then he points to something that's created by this exercise of will. All right, so we may have some received characterization of the numbers, but we're free to focus attention on certain parts of that and away from other parts. And in fact, that's one of our premier tasks as scientists, is to do that, or when it warrants being done. Okay, and so it's not necessarily what's given to us that's our creation, but once we make the choice of where to focus attention or concentration, the product of that is of our making in a very real sense, because we're the ones that chose the focus. Okay. Well, he, I think, expanded on this in many places, Dedekind did, and had quite a few interesting things to say about it. One of the most interesting, I believe, is something he said to Heinrich Weber in their correspondence, where they were talking about what Weber and Dedekind too often referred to as genetic descriptions of the numbers. And by that they meant descriptions like Frege was attempting, descriptions like Dedekind attempted to some extent, all right? So the idea was that we find these numbers to really know what they are, we have to find out where they come from. So we got to trace their bloodline back to the elements of thought, all right? And when we do that, then and only then can we really expect to have an understanding of the numbers. And so actually Weber was advocating the type of project that Frege was developing on exactly that kind of ground. He thought it was almost heroic in its goals. Dedekind disagreed, all right? And he said, consider the number four. The number four in Frege's system has lots of properties. Wow, all kinds of properties. One of those properties is that it has infinitely many members. Okay, so now does that become a fact of arithmetic? When we study the number four, are we going to highlight that? And he says, no, we certainly won't. It's a distraction. Okay, so we're going to turn our attention away from that property of the number four, even if we decide to do things a set theoretic way. We're going to get in there and change things so that the focus is not on the infinity of the number four, okay, but it's rather on the fact that it's the child of three and the mother of five, as he puts it so poetically. All right, so that's an example then of where he thinks the need to focus attention, that is our own choice and decision, our own contribution to mathematics, how that's important. Here's an example. So he's not arguing here against Frege's project in all respects. No. Do arithmetic set theoretically if you want. Go ahead. But you know what? It's going to end up looking a lot like arithmetic will look if you don't do it set theoretically. So what really would be the advantage? So this just says what I said. Maybe not. Let's take a look here. I think the general precept here is that in Dedekind's mind, that effective thinking often requires a type of focus that can only be achieved by, in some ways, replacing what's given with something else, okay? This is the result of this choice called abstraction or focus, all right? And axiomatization is one particular way to abstract. Dedekind and others thought it was a particularly effective way to do that. Others, I think, have thought it's less so. The big point is that we produce. We're the agents of production in abstraction. Okay? So those things that come out the other end of the abstraction machine, those are our creation. Well, now let's take a look, actually. Let's see. Yeah, I think I've already said that. There was so much literature on abstraction in the 18th and 19th century. It's one of the real, I spent a couple of years now reading this literature, and it's really one of the most interesting things I've ever done. Here is, so I wanted to give you a statement that not only made the points perhaps more clearly than Dedekind did, made the salient points more clearly, but also one that was very influential in determining general attitudes towards abstraction. Hamilton was, among logical and foundational writers, a quite influential figure for quite a while. This isn't William Rowan Hamilton, this is the Scottish philosopher, William Hamilton. So he said, abstraction is exclusive attention. When things are found to agree or to disagree in certain respects, the consciousness is, by an act of volition, concentrated upon the objects which thus partially agree, and in them upon those qualities in or through which they agree. This concentration constitutes an act of attention, which he thought was a kind of consciousness. The result of attention by concentrating the mind on certain qualities is thus to withdraw or abstract it from all else. Attention fixed on one object is tantamount to a withdrawal, to an abstraction of consciousness from every other. Okay? Now, if you were to read much more of Hamilton, you'd actually see a pretty serious attempt to define almost all of these terms. Okay? He was a very impressive guy when you gave him a problem like this where there weren't any distinctions, and he enters it, then boy, when you leave, you've got lots of distinctions and pretty careful, impressive ones too. I've highlighted in colored text here what I think are the main points for purposes of understanding what Dedekind's position really was and what those who thought like him, Hilbert, to some large extent too. Okay, the first thing is that abstraction is a kind of directing of something we might as well call attention or concentrated attention. Okay, and that this is an act of volition. Okay, it's that latter part, that act of volition, that can only exist if there's an agent of action that makes literal sense of speaking of creation. Okay. The agent of concentration is the creator. Okay. Now, actually, this is going to make things more difficult rather than less difficult, because the next question is, okay, who's the agent in mathematics? Is it one guy? Is it, well, anyway, you see what's going on. I mean, agency is actually going to turn out to be, I think, a big, tough problem for people who really want to take this seriously and do something with it. And I think Dedekind was certainly one who did. Now let's take a look at this passage from Hilbert where he talks about the totality of real numbers, all right? This is very much like the passage that we looked at before where he's talking about, I want to highlight now this time around his use of the term geregelt, okay, which means, signifies some sort of legitimate authority. All right. And so it's, now the akshamatizer is not just someone who directs attention or concentrates attention. The akshamatizer is rather someone who directs it in a legitimate way. Okay, and so now the legitimacy issues start coming out. What is a legitimate exercise of this power to focus attention or concentration? All right. And now I want to augment what Hilbert said and Dedekind said there with something that I think goes some way towards answering a question that I'm sure is on many of your minds. Okay, let's take Dedekind's view to an extreme. Did he really mean that we could direct attention or concentrate attention any way we wanted to? Well, no, everybody said no, you have to do it consistently. Okay, let's do it consistently. They had to do it fruitfully. That was another universal condition. All right, let's do it fruitfully. Is that it? I mean, so the person who goes in and akshamatizes is really not drawing upon some body of information when they choose which properties to highlight and which ones not to? This doesn't sound plausible. Okay. Hilbert, more than Dedekind, I think was keenly aware of that. Probably Bernays more than Hilbert, for that matter, okay. So anyway, in 34, they said this, informal akshamatization, they make this distinction between what's called formal akshamatik and inhaltliche akshamatik, formal akshamatization versus contentual akshamatization. And they say this, in formal akshamatization, the basic relations are not taken as having already been determined contentually. Okay. Oh. So there's not much descriptive constraint. Rather, they're determined implicitly by the axioms from the very start, and in all thinking with an axiomatic theory, only those basic relations are used that are expressly formulated in the axioms. And now I'll really come out and say it. Here's why descriptive adequacy is not involved, because that makes the relations essentially variables. Okay, they're just role players in conditions, and anything that can play that role can count. Okay, but this became a more highly reticulated view. All right. So now you see a partnership between contentual considerations and creative axiomatization. Okay, and so he says formal axiomatics requires contentual axiomatics as a necessary supplement. It's only contentual axiomatics that provides the guidance for choosing the axioms, as well as guidance on how to apply an axiomatic theory to reality. Okay. But he said we can't terminate axiomatization with contentual axiomatization. Okay, since in science we're predominantly, if not always, concerned with theories which do not completely represent reality, but whose significance consists in a simplifying idealization of reality. And I won't read the rest of it, but you might want to. Okay, so now we have this partnership. And you can see that because of the guiding function of contentual axiomatization, that there's going to be something that starts looking like a descriptive adequacy constraint. It maybe won't be exactly like the one you find in Whitehead and Russell and these other writers, but there's something that you've got to accommodate. right? The form of accommodation, the extent of accommodation, I think, are open to question here. And unfortunately, there's nothing further, really, that was ever said by Hilbert or Bernays to develop this idea that I know of. Okay, so I'm now to the point where I want to say that there's no natural bridge between this creative conception of actionization, okay, and Gödelian completeness as a constraint. This creative actionization is not going to be properly constrainable by such a condition. It's properly constrainable by many other conditions, consistency and fruitfulness being two, okay, but even the very idea of completeness is a little, it's hard to formulate, isn't it? I mean, when I found this passage years ago in Hilbert Bernays, I was kind of excited about this guy. Okay, now we're going to get something like something we can fit into Heiting's formulation, you know, something, some kind of data or something here that you got to capture. But it doesn't really turn out to be that way, because the role that inhaltliche Axiomatik plays with respect to formale Axiomatik is as an heuristic guide. So it's not actually the content of the inhaltliche Axiomatik that constrains the content of the formale Axiomatik, even if you suppose it's given a semantics, which Hilbert certainly didn't, okay? No, it's not that. It's something that kind of looks more psychological. All right, I said heuristic. Okay, I've got to finish, and so I'll just I'll state my conclusions and final question. I have two conclusions. First, a general one, and that is this: how should we think about these claims of mine? You might be thinking about it this way: Gödelian incompleteness is something that applies to a very wide range of theories. Okay? And so you might think that just because of the scope of its applicability, that it was therefore a very momentous and weighty control on, constraint on axiomatization, maybe inhibitor of axiomatization and its goals. But really what I want to say is that that's not the right way to think about it. Yes, it's Gödelian incompleteness does apply to a very wide range of theories. Okay, but before you can talk about whether the purposes of axiomatization are inhibited or obstructed or limited in some way, you first have to talk about the purposes of axiomatization. Okay? And so, in a sense, what I want to say is that you can't think of the range of implication of Gödel's theorems as being as great as the range of application. Okay, so the range of implication, I think, is a lot smaller than the range of application. That's what I say, essentially, here. And then the more specific conclusion is that there are at least two compelling, historically important forms of axiomatization, what I've called descriptive and creative, the pursuit of whose ideals doesn't seem to be inhibited by the facts concerning Gödelian completeness. I don't know what to think about that. I mean, there are moments when I think they can't be right. Okay, and I want to weaken it. And then I go back and it already seems pretty weak. But anyway, so I don't, anyway, that I tried to be careful in formulating this, so I have to stand by it. And now I'll leave you with a question, which is kind of the question that I've been thinking about the past while. And it's this. So suppose I'm right about these particular forms of axiomatization called descriptive and creative. Is there some goal of some kind of axiomatization that really is a compelling goal, and the type of axiomatization is compellingly significant in terms of its range, okay? Such that what's keeping us, such that Gödelian incompleteness is what's keeping us somehow from reaching whatever goals there are, though. So what compelling goals of axiomatization, I say, are there that we would have the knowledge to pursue in satisfying and effective ways were it not for Gödelian incompleteness, okay? And I think that's a pretty hard question to come up with an answer to, okay, because the candidates thinks like, well, how about, you know, the implications that Gödelian incompleteness has for categorical axiomatization. But the possibilities of categorical axiomatization are dim, quite independent of Gödel's theorem. I mean, you have robust non-categoricity for Gödelian complete theories, okay, among other things. And then you have where you find most of the categorical sets of axioms, I hesitate to say theories, is among second-order theories, second-order axioms, of course, but then the logic's not formalizable. Okay, and so we're not too interested in that to begin with. Anyway, that's where I'll stop.